Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Right back up the middle, and that's that. Lindor with a one-out single. And Ramirez clobbers it. Deep right. It's over. Heisey's heading off the wall. The Indians score first. Ramirez into second with an RBI double. 1-0 Cleveland. And one of the great matchups of the night belongs to Jose Ramirez. Looped it. Shallow left. Worth won't get there. It's going to drop for a hit. And Lonnie Chisenhall makes it 2-0 Cleveland.
Outfield straight, infield playing to pull on Victor. Here's the motion in the 2-0. And Martinez swings and drives one in the air. Deep into left field. Way. A solo shot to get things started here in the 15th, and the Tigers go ahead. And the 0-1. Seager swings, lines it to left field, going to get down a base hit. Cruz rounding third, comes home, he'll score. He's bobbled and left by Upton, throw to third, not in time. Seattle has tied it up. Now the set and the pitch, and Zunino swings high, fly ball center field. Collins backing up, he's under it. Lynn will tag, catch is made, here comes the throw, Lynn is going to score, and Seattle with a walk-off win.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Welcome indeed to the Extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader, and you know, Jim Cushlin, we said it was going to be nip and tuck for most of the summer, particularly into the late summer, and here we are. A little nip here, a little tuck there, and it's a 3.5 game lead in the American League Central. The Indians over the Tigers. The Indians get that win you just played over the Nationals. A very, very hard-fought game as Trevor Bauer is able to out-duel Max Scherzer, the former Tiger, one of the highest-paid players in baseball now, the highest-paid pitcher, certainly. And then the Tigers go out in, what is it, about 4 o'clock in the morning, our time?
Yeah, it would have to be about 4 o'clock. I honestly, I certainly was not awake for it, but my estimation is about 4 o'clock a.m. our time.
Yeah, I mean, late night out on the West Coast, early morning right here in on the east in the Eastern time zone. The Tigers end up dropping that one to the Mariners, and so it's a 3.5 game lead now for the Indians. 3.5, right? Not three.
Three and a half. It's 3.5, yep.
3.5 game right now lead for the Indians, and on we go. Nip and tuck, just like we thought it was going to be. So we're going to talk a little baseball this afternoon on the Extravaganza at 3:35 with Mr. Anthony Fenwick of the Detroit Free Press. Covers your Tigers, if indeed they are your Tigers, who lost in 15 last night. So we'll talk to Anthony about the state of the race and where the Tigers are, and what they'll have to do to try to close that gap, and how they can win this thing over the course of the last 7 weeks of the season, right? There's 7 weeks left, right?
About 7 weeks.
Six and a half.
Yeah, about six and a half, seven, until we get to that very first couple of days in October that happen to fall on a weekend. So that's when it's ending, I think, October 2nd or 3rd or something is the last day of the season.
Well, we'll call it a full seven, then. We'll call it 7 weeks. Call it seven. Today's the 10th, obviously, so 20 more days of August. All right, so we're going to talk to Anthony Fenwick about the race. We're going to get into college football at 4:05. Last week we did a really, really good interview. Or was that Monday?
No, that was Friday.
Was that Friday?
That was Friday.
We talked with Chris Lauderback, I believe it is. He's a great writer for 11 Warriors, which is an Ohio State website on SB Nation.
I have saved his number. We will certainly have him back on.
Yeah, he was very, very good, giving us a great Ohio State preview. Now we're going to go to the other side of things in the Big Ten, and we're going to get a preview from north of the state line and up in Ann Arbor. And Anthony Broom from MaizeandBrew.com, another SB Nation website, obviously this one devoted to the Wolverines. He will join us with a little preview there, talk about what the Wolverines are going to have to do to close the gap. You know, the gap in the standings wasn't big, just one game, but the gap on the field in the final regular season game of the year between the Wolverines and the Buckeyes was enormous. Just a butt-kicking as Jim Harbaugh's team really accomplished a lot in a single year, but they didn't do much to close the gap with Urban Meyer's Buckeyes. We'll talk to Anthony Broom about what they'll have to do that. By the way, Wolverines opened up at, what was it, number 8 in the preseason poll for the USA Today coaches poll?
I believe that was the case.
Buckeyes number 5 is where they came out with that. I believe that was last week that we found that out. Sports Illustrated has come out with their top 25, the SI top 25, not too terribly different from the USA Today coaches poll. The Bama Crimson Tide, expected to come back and do it again. Clemson, number 2, as Deshaun Watson is expected to take it up another notch. He's a Heisman Trophy candidate. Heisman Trophy favorite, maybe along with Christian McCaffrey. Number 3, the Florida State Seminoles, excuse me. I got a little ahead of myself because number 4 on the SI top 25 preseason is Jim Harbaugh's Michigan Wolverines, despite the loss of Jake Rudock. They believe, does SI, that the Michigan defense is going to be dominant, especially with do-it-all sensation Jabril Peppers, and they actually have them at number 4. Number 5, LSU. Number 6, Oklahoma. Number 7, Washington. Number 8, Houston. And if you're wondering when the heck I'm going to say the name of Ohio State, now, 9th. So that's, you know, I said not terribly different, but different. Four spots different than the USA Today coaches poll. From Sports Illustrated survey, they have Ohio State preseason at number 9, with just 2 senior returning offensive starters and 6 starters overall. So they expect the growing pains to be a little bit of an obstacle, if you will, for the young Buckeyes, for the inexperienced Buckeyes. Tennessee rounds out the top 10. If you're wondering about Christian McCaffrey, who I mentioned, who can do just about everything at any time and all times, maybe the best all-around football player in the country, his Stanford Cardinal check in at number 11.
And I was just going to say, go ahead.
Notre Dame, for fans who care, Notre Dame fighting Irish fans, and I know there are still a ton of those.
We're going to have some Notre Dame games here and there, by the way, this fall, too.
Yeah, oh, good.
Not the full slate. I'm sorry, guys, not the full slate. We already have a lot, but we're going to have some when we can, absolutely.
Well, run that down. Run that down. What are the plans for all for Ohio State, for Michigan, for Notre Dame?
Let's see. We got all the Michigan games. Yeah, Bowling Green will be on Talk Radio 1470 until they get to those Maction weekday games, and then we'll put them here on the ticket. You got Buckeyes on the ticket. All the Michigan games will be on our sister station, 100.7 The Zone. And, you know, due to conflicts, a lot of games happen at the same type of time. But when I don't have a conflict here on the ticket, I'm playing a Notre Dame game as well. So I can tell you their opener against Texas is going to be on later in September, I believe. Their game against Duke's going to be on. And they're still, college is annoying like this because once you get past September, they still don't have a lot of times officially set in stone yet.
Well, there are primarily, 6 teams that we pay attention to around here in Northwest Ohio. You know, we have Ohio State and Michigan.
Right.
And Michigan State and Notre Dame. And then, of course, Bowling Green and Toledo.
Yep. Covering all levels.
So we do. We do have it at all levels. So I already told you that Ohio State is preseason number 9. Michigan is preseason number 4 in the SI poll. Michigan State and Notre Dame helping us out here by going back to back. Notre Dame number 12, Michigan State preseason number 13.
And let's throw in, by the way, Iowa put number 14 on this SI list. A lot of them like them, whether it's Michigan, Ohio State, or Michigan State. Most people like them to face Iowa in a Big Ten title game later on. They check in at 14.
I think that's fair. Yeah, that very well could be, and probably would be the favorites, I guess I should say, to make it to the Big Ten title game. So just throw that out there at the start here. But I also want to get into some NFL, and I want to start there and we didn't talk about it yesterday. I kind of wanted to let this marinate a little bit. Plus, we had some other things going on yesterday. But the 3rd annual NFL quarterback tier rankings are out by ESPN. ESPN's Mike Sando put this together. And the tier rankings are a really, really interesting analysis of all of the quarterbacks. It's not just media members here, Jim. We see this a lot.
Right.
You know, CBS will have their quarterback rankings. ESPN will have theirs. The Sporting News, Fox, all the different, you know, services and people have their, you know, their rankings. But this is more interesting to me. This is interesting because this isn't media. These are league insiders. 3rd time they've done this now. And the 42 league insiders who were surveyed here include 10 general managers, and that's about the ultimate in terms of talent evaluators, the GMs, the guys who sign the contracts for these guys, 5 head coaches, 7 offensive coordinators, 5 defensive coordinators, which makes sense, 8 personnel evaluators, and 7 other position coaches slash executives. So really at every level of football, from the executive level to the general manager, front office level, to the position and player personnel level, to the head coach level, to the coordinator level, to the position coach level, all are reflected here in this ranking system. So the quarterback tier rankings include those 42 league insiders, and they were polled on 33 quarterbacks named. Now, there's one starter for every team, but they had 33 because of, you know, indecision on certain guys.
Right.
You know, as going into camp as who the starters are going to be. So they had 33 names, and each individual who was surveyed was asked to place each of the 33 quarterbacks into one of 5 tiers. Tier 1 being the very best quarterback, meaning, quote, and this is actually the definition of Tier 1, can carry his team each week. The team wins because of him. Tier 2 can carry the team sometimes, but not as consistently. Tier 3, legit starter, but needs heavy run game and defense to win. Tier 4 might not want to see this guy starting all 16 games. And Tier 5 quarterbacks ranked do not think this guy should be starting, period. So in the end, they averaged the tier rankings for each quarterback to produce a 1 to 33 ranking across 4 tiers. No starting quarterbacks received enough tier 5 votes to fall into the 5th tier. So eventually, all we have here are 4 tiers. Even though there were 5 possible, no one received enough tier 5 votes to be down in that category. Everybody was a little higher and ended up in the top 4 tiers.
Right.
Here are the 2016 NFL QB tier rankings with a full voting breakdown, which I'll share with a little bit later on. And there are only 3 players in Tier 1, according to these 42 industry, and when I say industry, I mean the industry of the NFL from the front office all the way down through the coaching staff, including some of the assistant coach levels. Here are the top 3 quarterbacks, the only 3 in Tier 1. They include, and these 2 individuals at the top tied with the number 1 ranking. Their average rating was 1.00. That means nobody had them in the 2nd tier or below. And those 2 guys you can probably guess are, Jim?
Let's see. Brady may be one of them. I'm trying to guess. I have the list in front of me.
Oh, you do? I didn't get it in front of me.
No, I
did. Okay, well, you're cheating. I wanted to
quiz you. See, I didn't want to cheat. That's why I'm like, well, wait a minute. I have it in front of me.
Yeah,
I
wanted to quiz you. Yeah, Tom Brady and Aaron Rodgers are
makes
the 2
perfect
tied
sense
at number 1. They are the only ones who did not get any tier 2 or below rankings from anybody. Tom Brady's rating last year was the same thing. Remember, this is the 3rd year they've done this. So he didn't budge. He was tied for first last year with Aaron Rodgers, and he remains tied for first this year with Aaron Rodgers. None of the 42 league insiders mention the 4-game suspension Brady is facing at the start of the season. They just are talking about who he is and what he is and what he does with his team. And again, you look at that tier description. Team wins because of him. If you can't say that about Tom Brady, you can't say it about anybody. And I think you could probably make the same exact case for Aaron Rodgers. The team doesn't do anything without him. He is a 1, even though he didn't play that way. And one head coach did say he's a 1, not a tier 2 guy, but he didn't play that way for the last part of last season. I went back and looked at all his games, said this coach, because he's one of the guys I like to study. I think he was changing too much stuff at the line of scrimmage. So he might have gone down a notch in terms of his play last year, but not enough to knock him out of the first tier. The only other quarterback to make it into the first tier, according to these league insiders, was not the NFL's reigning MVP, Cameron Newton, which has a lot of tongues wagging today. The only other guy in the top tier is Ben Roethlisberger of the Steelers. Roethlisberger's average rating among the 42 people who rated him, 1.21, which means just a very, very, very small number of the 42 evaluators had him in the 2nd tier. He drew a clear line, 33, let me put it to you this way, 33 of the 42 voters placed Roethlisberger in Tier 1. So a very clear line between him and the quarterbacks who are at Tier 2 and below. There were 0 complaints by those 42 who evaluated and gave their reasons as to why about the 16 interceptions that he threw last year, because insiders understood how much pressure was on him throwing 39 pass attempts per game. with Le'Veon Bell being out and the running game not being what it could be. Not to mention, their backs were against the wall because the four games that he missed due to injury, quarterbacked by Landry Jones and Michael Vick, didn't always go well. So they had to win a lot of, you know, must-win games. So they threw a ton. And when you throw as often as that, you know, one interception per game is not going to be a disqualifier. One GM said about Roethlisberger, I just admire how he can play big boy football. Another said, quite simply, he's a stud. He does some S, and it rhymes with bit. He does some S that is just off the map. There are some things that fall apart, and he gets off schedule, and that guy just makes plays. He has a hose. He is huge. He's so hard to bring down. He's so competitive. He's gritty. He's smart. We played him this past year, and our defense struggled that day because of him. That guy can win for you every week. So that's it. Brady and Rodgers were givens. Roethlisberger might be a bit of a surprise to some. Maybe not that he's first tier, because I agree with the ranking, but a surprise to some that he is first tier and a guy like Cam Newton is not, which is where we get to the real controversy and something I would like to discuss. And I want to hear from you at 866-240-1065. Cam Newton's the defending MVP, the reigning MVP. Almost took his team to a 16-0 season. Cam Newton threw 21 touchdown passes with just one interception in the second half of the season. How is he not in the first tier? His average rating was 1.57, but that gap between that and Roethlisberger's 1.21 was significant enough that that's where the cut line was, if you will. He's much closer at 1.57 to Drew Brees at 1.60, who is also tier 2, and 1.62, Russell Wilson, also tier 2. I'll read you the rest of tier 2, as a matter of fact, before we get into Cam. Andrew Luck, Philip Rivers, Eli Manning, Carson Palmer, who had a great year last year, by the way. Great year. How does this guy get more third-tier votes, 6, than first-tier votes, 2, after leading the league in total QBR and even getting an MVP vote for a 13-3 team? Carson Palmer might be too low there. He's number 10 overall in terms of average and in tier 2. Tony Romo at number 11 overall with an average rating of 2.14. Joe Flacco, an average rating of 2.19. Matt Ryan at 2.21. Matthew Stafford of the Lions checks in 14th overall. And it's important to bring that up, Kush, because we've talked with Lion fans about this in the past, you know,
right,
several months of the offseason as other media types have put out their top rankings, their top QB rankings, and their tiers, et cetera.
Yep.
But this one means more, as we said, because it's, you know, it's industry insiders. It's GMs and coaches and player personnel evaluators and coordinators and so on. They have Matthew Stafford ranked at number 14 overall with a 2.38 average ranking and toward the bottom end of Tier 2. In fact, only Andy Dalton is in Tier 2 below Matthew Stafford before we get into the Tier 3 quarterbacks. And I'm not going to read all of them right now. But Matthew Stafford, just to give you a few words because of the Lion fans in the audience, some voters think Stafford has become another Jay Cutler. Talented, but too flawed to belong in the upper tiers. Some thought losing Calvin Johnson to retirement would diminish Stafford further. But others familiar with recent coaching changes in Detroit think Stafford has a chance to flourish under coordinator Jim Bob Cushlin. I mean, Cooter. Stafford did come alive under Cooter last season, throwing 19 TDs with only 2 INTs over the final 8 games. They have changed a lot of the protection stuff that didn't make any sense, and it looks like they're going to let Stafford push it down the field more, one offensive coach said in the survey. You're going to see Stafford play really damn well. A GM called Stafford an erratic decision maker, however, and a late decision maker, but he also thought the Lions failed to support him sufficiently through the offensive line in the running game. Stafford reminds me so much of Cutler, a pro personnel director said. It will be interesting to see if he's better or worse without Megatron, because I think he relied too much on finding him. When you are the second fiddle on a team like Stafford has been with Megatron around, you have a way out. You can be a little less accountable. Now, I'm going to skip down just for the sake of the comparison, because they said he's like Jay Cutler. Cutler is in Tier 3, way down at number 21. The Jay Cutler experiment in Chicago is like the Jay Cutler experiment everywhere else where he's been. He just alienates people. Remember the old book? What is it? Was it by Carnegie, the How to Win Friends and Influence People? the old personal, like, self-help book kind of a thing?
I think so, but I'm not sure.
Jay Cutler wrote How to Lose Friends and Piss People Off, okay? Because that's just, you know, it's a different book. It's a different kind of, that's how he lives his life. That's how he lives his career. So that's a bad comparison for Matthew Stafford, but I want to know how Lions fans feel about him being at number 14 and in Tier 2. But back to the real discussion point that I would like to have, and a lot of folks are having on the national level today, on radio and in print and on blogs, et cetera, et cetera. How does Cam Newton, the MVP of the league, end up in Tier 2? He made a huge jump, by the way, because last year when this very same survey was done, the top tier rankings with 42 league insiders, when the same survey was done, Cam Newton was down there in the 20s. And now Cam Newton makes a huge jump after throwing 20, no, not in the 20s, beg pardon. He was 14th last year, but that's where Matthew Stafford is this year. So it's a huge jump from 14 to 4 for Cam Newton. He made a huge jump after throwing 21 TDs with just one INT over the last regular season, 8 regular season games. One defensive coordinator says, it's a resounding 1 for me, meaning he should be in the first tier. And this is a guy who faced him multiple times. So probably in division. Doesn't matter. They don't identify themselves. Guess who is the cornerstone of their running game, said this coordinator? It's Cam Newton. Guess who's the cornerstone of their passing game? It's Cam Newton. Who are his wide receivers? He has Greg Olsen. Anybody else? He goes out there and gets it done consistently. He has a big, powerful arm. He's not a great passer, but he is a great thrower. He can carry your football team. 18 out of the 42 voters placed him in the top tier. And that's why he didn't make it to the top tier, because far more placed him in the second tier.
24 to 18, incidentally.
24 to 18, since you did the math there. Thank you, Jim. Some of the others said they would follow suit if Newton played at a high level over the course of a full season, but they point out that in the first 8 games last year, he had 14 touchdowns to 9 interceptions. Very, very pedestrian. Not going to get you a top tier anywhere. The fact that he turned it around over 8 games and went 21 TDs with one INT is spectacular. But if you take a look at the whole season as a body of work, it's an MVP season, but it doesn't add up to a top tier overall ranking because you haven't done that last 8 games for a full 16, let alone what Brady, Rodgers, and Roethlisberger have done, which is to do great things over multiple seasons. And that is what the argument against Cam Newton is. He ranked 24th in total QBR, 53.7 completion rate through Carolina's first 8 games. But thanks to a stellar Carolina defense, many of those on the survey note, the turnovers that Newton committed rarely cost the Panthers points that would have cost them games. Carolina allowed 32 points off 19 turnovers, good for a league low 1.7 points allowed per turnover. That's a huge reason they got off to that 14-0 start. One pro personnel director said, I'm very close to making him a 1. The only thing that scares me is that he's inconsistent. I don't know how you change that. And we can go ahead and just kind of jump forward from that 14-0 start to the 15-1 regular season there and skip over to the Super Bowl and say, what, when everything was on the line, did Cam Newton do? Did he rise up and play like a Tier 1 quarterback? And we all know that playing against one of the great Super Bowl defenses we've seen in recent years, maybe of all time, that Denver defense, he didn't. So if you take if you take 14 touchdowns to 9 interceptions in the first 8 games, and then you skip over the second half and add the playoff performance, particularly in the Super Bowl, you see a guy who is very, very inconsistent. The 8 games that have him as high as he is are fantastic. 21 touchdowns, 1 pick, but can one invalidate the other? According to the surveyors and the 42 insiders, no, one can't invalidate the other. You have to accept all of it. Accept the greatness, but also accept the very inconsistent performances in the beginning of the season and in the Super Bowl. And guess what you have? A guy who's just a little shy of the first tier of Brady, Rodgers, and Roethlisberger. Do you agree with this? I want to hear from you. And I know we got to talk to Anthony Fennec here in a few minutes, but I want to go ahead and set that table again and throw the number out at 866-240-1065. Is Cam Newton getting slighted? Is he being held to a different standard for some reason? Is he being treated unfairly here? The MVP not being a Tier 1 guy? You tell us. And also, how do you feel about Matthew Stafford? If you're a Browns fan and you're wondering why I haven't mentioned their starting quarterback, there's a good reason, because it's a pretty embarrassing number, which I will share with you later. By the way, if you're wondering if any of Cam Newton's detractors pointed to his, you know, Super Bowl, his post-Super Bowl pout festival as maybe being a reason why they degraded him and did not put him in a number one spot, but in a second tier, zero of those 42 insiders, zero, used that as justification for anything. They didn't mention it. They didn't say it impacted them one way or the other. They completely ignored it. The vision of that widely panned incident did come to mind, with some voters describing him as a front runner. He's really, really great with the media when he's winning and he's all happy, but if he's losing, he starts to pout and sulk. But none of them evaluated that as a reason, or used that as part of the reason for their evaluation, is the better way to say it. One GM did say he's got rare energy when things are going good. It's as good as it gets, and he can lead when he's out in front. But when things aren't going well, that's when he makes mistakes. He has bad energy for the team. He sucks the life out of it. He's a manic quarterback. But as long as his defense performs, as long as big plays are made that bail him out, that will always re-energize him. And it's believed that that GM did indeed actually rank him as one of the top tiers. So they did not mention the post-game press conference as an example. So there you go. So top three are Brady and Rodgers tied at first, with Roethlisberger third. And then you have the tier two, which includes Cam Newton at number four overall and Matthew Stafford down there at number 14. How do you feel about it? We want to talk about it in just a bit. But right now we'll get a timeout here for a SportsCenter. We'll come back, shift gears to Major League Baseball. Why? Because Anthony Fenech is standing by. Fenech, of course, covers the Tigers for the Detroit Free Press. Tigers dropped 1-15 early morning baseball because it was out on the West Coast up there in Seattle. So they drop one to the Mariners to drop 3.5 behind the Indians. Fennec will make some sense of all that for us coming up next, right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Now the set and the pitch, and Zunino swings high, fly ball center field. Collins backing up, he's under it. Lynn will tag, catch is made, here comes the throw. Lynn is going to score, and Seattle with a walk-off win.
A walk-off win is a walk-off loss for the Tigers, unfortunately, and the deficit now is back to 3.5 as they trail the Cleveland Indians, who won yesterday at Washington against Max Scherzer, the former Tiger. And so the lead, it just, you know what, it's like we said, you know, the lead got pushed down to 7.5, and all of us said, wow, never saw this really coming. We thought it would be a nip-and-tuck race all the way through the late summer. Well, here we are on August 10th, and it is exactly that. To see it go from 3-2, 2-3, 4-3, 2-1, 4 again is not surprising at all, or at least it would not be for me. The Indians with the great pitching staff, the Tigers with a tremendous lineup, and that's where we are. So it's 3.5 now after last night's results in 15. K-Rod blows it. Joining us to talk about it is Anthony Fenech, who covers the Detroit Tigers, of course, for the Detroit Free Press. Mr. Fenech, how are you, sir?
Good, how are you?
I'm good, man. You all right? You sleeping? You awake?
Yeah, I'm hanging in there.
Okay, you sound a little down. Did you stay up and watch every pitch last night? Is that why you're a little slow to get moving?
I'm not. I actually cut the radio feed out after the Victor Martinez home run, and I woke up in the morning and I saw the box score and I was like, oh man.
That's not fun, is it? That's,
oh man, that's what I thought, especially because it's kind of putting a wrench into my plans for my Friday 1A story about how the Tigers have turned things around. Couple of key points there highlighted in the future story. Shane Green and Francisco Rodriguez. So that story has lost a little bit of steam and could be held here depending on tonight's contest.
Now, can you just rewrite that a little bit and say, despite, you know, Tuesday night's 15th inning meltdown for K-Rod, it has been blah, 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 and get right back to what you wrote?
I could. I just don't think that the fine folks at the Detroit Free Press are going to put how the Tigers have turned things around on the front page if they've lost four straight.
Gotcha. Fair enough. That makes sense. Although your colleague Drew Sharp has written something for yesterday, I guess it was, and I'm just looking at the website, and that is crediting Brad Ausmus for the Tigers' surge in the standings, and they have indeed surged. As I mentioned at the top, despite the recent struggles, their 8-game winning streak, coupled with the Indians, you know, losing quite a bit, very consistently, had narrowed this thing down to at least 2 games at one point. That's as close as it got. And Brad Ausmus, certainly deserves some credit for that. Isn't it amazing? Kushlin and I were talking about this like on Monday or something. It seemed like just a blink of an eye ago that we were all on Brad Ausmus watch, full-time Ausmus watch. When is the axe going to fall? Because they were struggling. They had lost, I don't know, at one point did they lose?
It was
like
10 of 11, I think.
10 of 11? And I don't remember how many in a row. It might have been like 7 in a row and 10 out of 11. And we were all wondering when Brad Ausmus was going to get clipped. And here we are now, and who would have thought that on August 9th, August 10th, you know, we're writing articles or reading articles from the Free Press about Brad Ausmus, being the key figure in this resurgence.
Yeah, when you bring up Brad Ausmus watch, that brings back some bad memories, perhaps some sleepless nights there early in the season. But I agreed with the premise of Drew's column. I don't think that Brad deserves too much credit for this. I mean, just in the same sense that I don't think he deserved too much criticism for what happened at the beginning of the season. But at the end of the day, baseball is a business, it's a results-driven sport, and the fact is the Tigers are about 8 games over 500 right now. So when people are coming into my live chats on Tuesday asking me what grade I give them about a B plus right now, because they're playing pretty well. I just think that, I think that Brad's made some significant strides this season. I think it helps that he's got a bullpen to actually manage. And I think from talking to some of the guys in the front office, it's one of the things that he's done best is manage that bullpen and, keep guys fresh. It'll drive the fans nuts sometimes that he won't, throw Shane Green out there 3 days in a row, but in the fans' mind, every game is a must-win game, and in Brad's mind, you got to go play for the long haul. I mean, the Tigers have always felt from day one that he's going to be a very good major league manager one day. But at the beginning of the season, it was getting very dicey to the point where if they lose maybe that series against Minnesota after that 10 or 11 game split, 11 game slide. Things could have went differently, but I think it's a testament to Brad and the way that he's managed the team that they've fought through the ups and the downs of the season so far, and they find themselves smack dab in the middle of a pennant race right now.
Yeah, we're talking to Anthony Defenick, analyzing the Tigers and how they went from where they were when we were on Ausmus firing watch to now maybe Ausmus being considered as American League Manager of the Year. And that's something that that Drew actually wrote about. But he pointed out also, it is the guys who are supposed to do great things doing great things that always make managers look good. Miguel Cabrera, Victor Martinez found renewed power in their bats, and I'm quoting Drew now from his article, and Justin Verlander pitching like a serious Cy Young candidate. Ian Kinsler meriting genuine consideration for American League MVP. Michael Fulmer, the early favorite for AL Rookie of the Year. So it kind of does always come back to the guys on the field. And you're right. Managers, in these situations get too much blame when you have the skid, and probably a little too much credit when these guys start performing well, unless there's something that it can be specifically pointed to that a manager has done to generate that production. To some of those issues, let me ask you, Anthony Fenick, do you agree with a lot of what Drew just wrote there? Is there a serious consideration for Justin Verlander here on August 10th as maybe a Cy Young candidate?
I think so. I mean, I think he's definitely one of the top five pitchers in the league for sure, and I think he's kind of proven that this season with the way he's bounced back at full health. I mean, he's been, a horse once again. He's up there in the top of the American League in innings pitched, strikeout rate's the highest since 2009, he's really used that short slider, he calls it, and he's been able to manipulate speeds with it, and that to me has really kind of separated him once again from the pack. I mean, look, there's a lot of guys in the American League that have a great season, like, Corey Kluber with the Indians, Chris Sale with the White Sox, guys like that. I mean, even Michael Fulmer, I mean, he's about to qualify for the ERA title, and he should be leading the league at that point, barring any sort of, really bad outing that Fulmer hasn't had in a while. But I definitely think he's one of the top five guys in the AL, and if not, maybe top three. So I think he's going to definitely get his share of Cy Young votes. I mean, there's still 2 months to go in the season, you know what I mean? And if he keeps this up, I definitely think he'll be up there. I can't say he's a front runner or anything like that, but I definitely think he should be considered for the Cy Young at this point.
Yeah, we should probably throw Cole Hamels' name in there, too, I would imagine. You know, for the team with the best record in the American League, Texas, they Hamels is 12-3 with a 2.89 ERA. He's 144 strikeouts,
good, yeah,
which is top five, I think, as well. Who would you throw in there with Justin if you say he's top five? Who would be the other four? Is Hamels one of them?
Yeah, I say Hamels has to be one of them. When you bring up his ERA, Chris Sale, obviously he's had a really good season. Corey Kluber's had good numbers too. So I think you guys would put him up there. I'm trying to think of another guy in the AL.
Aaron Sanchez now is leading, by the way, in the ERA category at 2.85. He's 11-2 with a 2.85, 121 strikeouts to 42 walks. I mentioned Hamels with a 12-3 with a 2.89, 144, 56 walks. And then just looking at ERA only, Jose Quintana, the White Sox, generally speaking, though, it's not a good team. He's not going to be getting much consideration. Then Marco Estrada, Toronto, 2.95. Danny Duffy, and then we're getting to some other Stephen Wright, J.A. Happ. Chris Sale, you mentioned, is 8th. Corey Kluber is 9th. Tanaka with the Yankees is 10th. Salazar with the Indians might have had some talk before he went on the DL and got banged around a little bit before he went to the DL. So, yeah, I mean, if you're looking for five names, I can certainly see, even though Justin Verlander's 3.52 ERA as of today is only good for 15th in the league. He is 12-6. You pointed out he's among the league leaders in strikeouts and innings pitched, 153 innings, 164 strikeouts. So, you know what, Verlander, Hamels, Sanchez, probably Sale, and maybe Kluber, would that be your five?
Yeah, probably at this point. I mean, I think you got to kind of look at the I think you have to kind of look at the Cy Young race a little bit like the MVP race as well. I mean, you know, you take away Justin Verlander at the Tigers, and they're really going to be hurting. So, you know, you kind of got to factor in multiple things. Like you said, with Cole Hamels, I mean, the Rangers are in first place, and he's their ace. So he was a guy that I overlooked at the beginning of this segment, but I think that he's definitely one up in there, probably top two. But I definitely think Verlander's in the discussion right now for sure.
Yeah, and obviously there's what six, 7 weeks. Jim and I were just talking about left of baseball, so you know a lot of this will ferret itself out in the course of the rest of August and September. We'll figure out who is really, you know, deserving of those awards. Let's circle back to the beginning of our conversation, and that is, you know, K-Rod, as you might have to adjust your story if they don't get a win tonight or today. But K-Rod did blow his third save of the season. Second straight opportunity that he was unable to close on. And do you have any concerns there? Is this just, hey, the life of a closer, he hits a bad stretch and things are okay, or any reason for larger concerns?
I mean, how do I say this? I mean, he's been very solid this season. There's no doubting that. He's been very positive for the Tigers, both on the field, off the field, mentoring some of the young players. And look, his numbers are fine, but he's been really struggling as of late. I'd say probably his last, you know, six or seven outings. His stuff's become much more hittable. He's walking to guys. Obviously, you know, he's a little bit of a problem getting left-handed hitters, keeping the ball in the yard. Four of his five home runs have been allowed to lefty hitters. And just for me, I know the numbers, I know the track record, I know the career stats for Francisco Rodriguez, but for me, he's just, whenever he takes him on, you're kind of wondering, he's a little bit on shaky ground. And, he's turned into a guy that's very reliant on his changeup. And I think that as the season's worn on, I think that, teams are very aware that his changeup is essentially his fastball now. And he can't really blow that fastball by guys. And he's really out there getting guys out with, you know, a lot of experience and a lot of, the mental aspect of the game, which look, you get it done any way you get it done, right? You get saves that way. But it started to catch up to him lately. He's just not the lockdown closer he once was. He's almost turned into a bit of a trick pitcher, a guy that, you know, like I said, he just relies on that changeup too much for my liking. Every time he enters the game, you just wonder what could happen. That being said, he hasn't been as shaky as some of the closers of Tigers past, but we're kind of going down that road again right now. But you talk to the guys inside that clubhouse, and manager of the front office, and they've all been more than happy with the job he's done. But again, there's 2 months left in the season, and he's been struggling as of late. So from my perspective, he's a little bit shaky, but he's a guy the Tigers could live with and are going to have to live with at the back end of the bullpen at this point.
Anthony Cushlin here, and on the other side of things, especially when we're talking about the Verlander in the Cy Young conversation, complete flip side of that is Jordan Zimmermann, who was on the DL for quite a while, came back, couldn't get out of the second inning in his start, and now right back on the DL. What's his status, and when can the Tigers expect him back?
Well, Brad said on Sunday he was going to be picking up a baseball for 4 days, which would mean he might be picking up a ball today or tomorrow. He's going to rejoin the team in Texas, so I'd imagine that might be tomorrow. Got to be a big concern because Tigers are really counting on Zimmermann to rejoin that rotation and be kind of like the number two pitcher. Now, look, I don't think he's as good as he was in April, 0.55 ERA, but I definitely don't think he's as bad as he's been. After April, he's at a 6.44 ERA since May, but this has to be concerning not only because they really don't know, they're not quite sure of what's wrong with him in terms of the, right neck strain, same issue. They put him on the DL with a re-aggravation of that, but it could be, related to a shoulder issue, but I get the sense that the Tigers would have really preferred that he went out and did another rehab with Triple A Toledo, but I don't think that was in the cards from his angle. Remember, you have to consent to have another rehab start. Zimmermann felt he was fine. The Tigers took him at his word, but he just wasn't out there. Just didn't look the same, like the same pitcher that Jordan Zimmermann's been over his course of his career. His fastball's in the high 80s. He just had no life, and the White Sox were a bad team. They really hit him around. Tigers starting pitching is a bit of a concern right now. It really is. I mean, they got three rookies in the starting rotation, relying a lot on that youth. So they really need Zimmermann to come back, and not only come back, but come back and be a pitcher that they can count on, because right now they really can't count on it.
You know what, Anthony, a team is really never as good as an eight-game winning streak shows that they are, and they're never as bad as a long losing streak does, unless you're, not a team that's where the Tigers are anyway. So what's the reality here with 7 weeks to play before this is done? Especially if they lose their fourth in a row today. You got injuries. You got Zimmermann. Cameron Maben going to the DL. You got guys who have come off the DL like JD, and you're hoping they can be consistent and do some things. So in reality here, what is your prognosis for the next 7 weeks? Do they have enough juice? Do they have enough health? I mean, that's a big part of this. Do they have enough to really make this a run in not just on August 10th, but on September 10th and into the final couple of weeks of the season?
Strictly based on the gut feel, I think this is going to be a team that is really, and I feel like I'm taking the easy way out here, but this is going to be a team that's going to be in the thick of the race. I don't think that this is a team that has enough starting pitching to distance themselves at all and to have any kind of a comfortable lead towards the end of the season, but I think they have enough major league talent, enough seasoned major league talent, enough winning ability on the team. I mean, look, this is a team that from 2011 through 2014, really, they were playing in, the ALCS pretty much every year. I mean, I had lost in the ALDS in 2014. Last year was kind of an aberration. These guys have a lot of good baseball players on their team, and that's kind of what I'm hitching the wagon on right now. But again, the question's going to be the starting pitching. They don't have enough for my liking. I don't see them having enough to, kind of eclipse the Indians, no matter how the Indians have been playing lately. I just think that Indians came back to earth a little bit, but I still think that they have a lot more upside just because of the starting pitching. But I definitely think the Tigers are amongst the crop of teams, that are battling out for the wild card. They just have a lot of talent. And the question is going to be Zimmermann now, as it was in the beginning of the season with Aníbal Sanchez. Now the question is Zimmermann, because you get in the postseason, even down the stretch, because really they're not just playing to, we're not looking ahead towards the postseason, but down the stretch, you'd really like to have a Verlander, Fulmer, Zimmermann. Then you get into the postseason with that kind of staff. Well, then coupled with that offense, you got something going. But I mean, the one thing that kind of stands out to me could be their antidote for the rotation was the bullpen, and I think it's been much improved over the last few seasons. Almost the strength of the team. It's been a while since you can say the bullpen's been more solid than the starting rotation, but that's the thing right now. So I think with the kind of offense they have, the bullpen they have, my gut tells me they're definitely going to be in the race at the end. If you're asking me to put a percentage on it, I'd say for the division, I'd say the Indians have, let's say 60-40 Indians. For the wild card, it's the Tigers got maybe
45%.
Yeah, they fell one game with last night's loss. They fall one game back at the second wild card spot. Hey, Jim. Anthony Fenech. We're talking with Anthony Fenech, Detroit Free Press. Jim Cushlin is here as well. Hence the name, Jim. Just real quick, couple of quick baseball notes. Your thoughts, Prince Fielder wrapping it up because of a medical condition. He's going to have another neck surgery apparently, and he ends his career as a former Tiger, of course, former Brewer, where he hit most of his home runs, but former Tiger too. Ends his career with 319 home runs, just like his dad Cecil. How will you remember Prince Fielder's career?
Over too short. You look back at Miguel Cabrera's career and two of his best offensive seasons. I don't think there was a coincidence that Prince Fielder was hitting behind him and he was healthy. It's just crazy to see how Prince Fielder, who was kind of like one of the Iron Men of the game, how it fell so quickly because of those neck issues. But I guess if there's a place not to have an injury, it's got to be the neck. Over too soon, a terrific power hitter, left-handed guy. A guy that I think was misunderstood a little bit, because of his comments after the 2003 playoffs. A guy that was generally good to be around. He was pretty reserved. I remember when I was a young reporter that was yet on the beat, but he used to give me some crap from time to time, but it was all well natured. So it's really unfortunate. I think the game of baseball is a better game with Prince Fielder around and his smile. And I know he was very close to Cabrera. His time in Detroit probably won't be remembered very fondly because fans are all about winning. They don't like when their superstar players are telling them that, there's things that are more important than winning. So I think that was kind of got off on the wrong foot or ended on the wrong foot. From the Tigers' perspective, they were tripping over themselves to make that Ian Kinsler deal, and it's very hard to see where they would be right now if they had not made that deal and if Prince Fielder was one of those contracts that's just lopped up on the books. So
and they will remain there. Whoa, I don't know what that was. That sounded like some feedback. Are you still there, Anthony? It looks like we lost him. His phone died. Jim Cushlin, I heard some hints that he might be crapping out on his phone through some of his conversations. I heard some strange sounds and glitches and bleeps and whatnot. So I'm not surprised. But that's okay. It timed up pretty well. I wanted to ask him about Tim Tebow, and maybe we'll talk more about that later on in the second hour of the program as well. With callers at 866-240-1065 as to whether or not Tim Tebow can and should get an opportunity and whether he would be able to do anything trying to become a professional baseball player at the age of 29 after not having played for 11 years, 2005, the last time he played baseball on a full-time basis. So we'll get into that a little bit in the last hour, but also coming up after the top of the hour Sports Center, which is right around the corner here, we are going to talk college football. We did a great Ohio State preview on Friday with 11warriors.com and SB Nation site. Today we go to maizeandbrew.com. Anthony Broom, our friend from Maize and Brew, will join us at about 4:05 to talk Wolverines football. By the way, if you missed it earlier in this show, the Sports Illustrated preseason top 25 has been released, and the Wolverines are top five. And in fact, they are five spots higher than their neighbors and friends, and by friends I mean hated enemies, down in Columbus, the Buckeyes at number 9. We'll see what Anthony Broom thinks about that. We'll get your calls going as well. We'll talk a little more about Tebow and, of course, the Olympics. Michael Phelps doing America proud in ways that you can't really describe from an Olympic standpoint. All of that still to come in hour number 2 of the Extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Right back up the middle, and that's that. Lindor with a one-out single. And Ramirez clobbers it. Deep right. It's over. Heisey's heading off the wall. The Indians score first. Ramirez into second with an RBI double. 1-0 Cleveland. And one of the great matchups of the night belongs to Jose Ramirez. Looped it. Shallow left. Worth won't get there. It's going to drop for a hit. And Lonnie Chisenhall makes it 2-0 Cleveland. That is the risk you run when you bring the infield in.
Yeah.
You open up those little bloop areas on the field.
Outfield straight, infield playing to pull on Victor. Here's the motion and the 2-0. And Martinez swings and drives one in the air. Deep into left field, way.
A solo shot to get things started here in the 15th, and the Tigers go ahead.
And the 0-1. Seager swings, lines it to left field, going to get down a base hit. Cruz rounding third, comes home, he'll score. He's fouled and left by Upton, throw to third, not in time. Seattle has tied it up. Now the set and the pitch, and Zunino swings high, fly ball center field. Collins backing up, he's under it. Lynn will tag, catch is made, here comes the throw. Lynn is going to score, and Seattle with a walk-off win.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed, hour number two is underway at 9 minutes past the top right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. Phone lines are going to be open at 866-240-1065 for you to talk about any of the things we covered in hour number one, including the American League Central race, including the top-tier rankings of the NFL quarterbacks. By 42 paneled, surveyed experts and industry insiders. But we want to start hour number two with college football. As we say good afternoon to Anthony Broom with MaizeAndBrew.com, an SB Nation website devoted to the University of Michigan Wolverines. A little preview of the Big Ten season for the Wolverines. Anthony, how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing well, Bob. How are you?
Outstanding, sir. It's great to have you back again to talk a little college football. And what an interesting way to start the season for the Wolverines in the Sports Illustrated Top 25 poll. I looked at it and I thought not going to be too dissimilar from what the coaches poll was by USA Today announced last week for the preseason. They were ranked number 8 there. Ohio State was ranked number 5. Alabama number 1. In both of those surveys. But lo and behold, we take a look at Sports Illustrated, and the Wolverines are in the top 5 at number 4. Did that surprise you?
I'm not really all that surprised. If you look at what Michigan has coming back from last year, you know, all of their stars are back. Most of their top talent returns. It's another year of Jim Harbaugh. And hype is at an all... It might be at an all-time high right now in Ann Arbor. So I'm not all that surprised. Do I think that there are only 3 teams better than them in all of college football? That remains to be seen. But, you know, the preseason rankings are, you know, a lot of times they'll look very different than what they will at the end of the year. So, I'm not putting a whole lot of stock into that, but, you know, in terms of, you know, what they have coming back, who they have on the sidelines, you know, I definitely think they're one of the better, you know, 5-10 best teams in college football.
I would have been okay with that. I would have been okay with what you just said. One of the 5 best teams, or 5 to 10 best teams in college football. Top 5, though, and as you say, only 3 teams being better. And I know, I don't put a whole lot of stock into preseason rankings either. In fact, I don't put a whole lot of stock into the first 5 weeks of rankings. I think you got to see teams play 3 or 4 games minimum before you can really have a true look at what the top, you know, 25 teams in college football are. But be that as it may, this is a team that has a lot coming back, as you pointed out, but it's also a team that is trying to find a new quarterback. And even in, you know, in the NFL, of course, it's off the charts important, that position. But at the top college level, they would not have been where they were without Jake Rudock's improvement and ascension throughout that season. And now he's gone, and they're going to have to find, and they're picking from among 3 possibilities, they're going to have to find that field general, and they're going to have to find him early. That's the reason I'm a little bit surprised by the top 4 ranking.
Yeah, you know, the thing with them is, like you said, you're not going to really know what they are until you know, almost halfway through the year. They don't really have a tough game on their schedule until they head to Michigan State in late October. I think the schedule sets up for them to find their quarterback. You know, I think they'll start out the year pretty high in the rankings, somewhere in that 4 to 7 or 8 range. And Michigan fans will just kind of have to get used to the, you know, people saying that they're overrated or that they haven't played anyone yet because, you know, and we can't say this for sure, but, you know, the schedule does look pretty easy, for the first, you know, half to 2/3 of the season. So, we'll see what happens there. And you're absolutely right about Jake Rudock. You know, it was kind of, I don't want to say it was a miracle, what happened with him, but I don't think anyone really saw him taking the steps forward as far as he did, under Jim Harbaugh. I know people were confident that, you know, he'd be good enough and exactly what they would need, but, you know, things were better than expected. And I think that's caused a lot of people to, you know, they give Jim Harbaugh the benefit of the doubt when they're looking at this quarterback battle. It looks like it's going to be between John O'Korn and Wilton Spate. And I think both of those guys have a real good shot at being, whoever wins the job, being, you know, pretty darn good quarterbacks. But, you know, just because, you know, development isn't always linear. Just because Jim Harbaugh did something with one guy doesn't mean he's going to turn, you know, these other two guys into, you know, what Jake Rudock was, or even into All-Americans or anything like that. It's a wait-and-see thing, but on paper, yeah, I think quarterback is a definite question mark. I wouldn't say that they're inexperienced. I just think they're unproven, and they'll have a lot of time to prove it before they really have a good test. So.
We're talking to our good friend Anthony Broom of MaizeandBrew.com, an SB Nation site devoted to the Michigan Wolverines. So you mentioned Spate and O'Korn. Obviously, you left out Shane Morris. He is not any longer a consideration for this job?
I'm sure he's in consideration, but I think it's going to take a really big camp out of him. And, you know, this will be his fourth year in Ann Arbor. At this point, obviously, we, you know, Jim Harbaugh kind of has the Midas touch with quarterbacks, but, you know, based on what we've seen, I think at this point, Shane Morris kind of just is what he is. He might end up being a good backup for them, but I don't know how much of a factor he plays in that battle. Like I said, I lean more to more towards O'Korn and Wilton Spate. I do think O'Korn has a slight edge there, but, you know, both guys will be neck and neck throughout camp.
Why do you give the edge to O'Korn?
I think at the end of the day, he's I think Wilton Spate is a guy who's steady. He's I won't call him a game manager, but he doesn't get rattled. He makes smart decisions. I think big play potential is a little more with John O'Korn. That's not to say he's erratic or turnover prone, but I think that the risk or the reward kind of outweighs the risk there. He'll maybe throw an interception or two here and there, but I think he has a bigger arm and, you know, the skill set to make some plays with his feet and his arm that maybe Wilton Spate doesn't quite have. So that's why I would give him the edge. But like I said, it's 1A and 1B right now. Whoever the guy ends up being, I think Michigan will be in good hands at quarterback.
We'll talk more personnel in a second. Jim Kushlin is here, though. He wants to go back to the rankings for a moment. Jimmy, go ahead.
Yeah, and it kind of goes into something that you said about, Anthony, about how Michigan is bringing back, relatively speaking, an experienced crew, and I think that had something to do with the rankings. And I want to get your thoughts on this because I've heard a lot of people, whether they're the Ohio State side, whether the Michigan side, or a neutral in this case, when talking about, in these rankings, Michigan and where Ohio State is, that Michigan, I could see why they're ranked high, and the gist goes like this. I could see why Michigan's ranked higher, but by the time you get to Ohio State, Michigan, it's very possible that Ohio State will actually be ranked higher. Do you buy into that at all, or is this just another one of those their preseason rankings? It is what it is.
I'm like I said earlier. I think what you are in September is far off from what you're going to be or what you should be in November. Ohio State has maybe more question marks across the roster than Michigan does. Obviously, they have a established starter in JT Barrett, so that helps a lot of things. A lot of people very high on him. I am as well. You know, but you have a whole season to figure those out and let guys prove themselves. And, you know, if there's a game on that, I would say if there's a game on the schedule that I wouldn't be confident in Michigan winning, it would be at Ohio State just because, you know, despite what they lose, they still have, you know, 4 and 5 stars on the depth chart waiting for an opportunity behind those guys that left. So I think that team might be a little more talented. We'll see if it plays out on the field, but we'll see. I mean, like I said, you could take or leave the rankings this time of year. I think on paper it looks like today Michigan has a better football team, but that might not be the case in late November. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens.
The kind of follow up to that, real quick, is regardless. Again, I know these are preseason rankings, but the only Big Ten teams I'm seeing right now in anywhere of these rankings is you got in no particular order: Michigan, Michigan State, Ohio State, and Iowa. From a zoomed out Big Ten perspective, and you're absolutely right, teams are going to look a lot different at the end of November around Thanksgiving than they do right after Labor Day in September. But should we be surprised if down the stretch in the Big Ten, it's somebody other than those four schools that I just mentioned?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised at all because I think you said Michigan State and Iowa. I still think Iowa's very good, but if there's anyone that's always proved people wrong and kind of thrives off of, I won't say disrespect, but, you know, being under the radar, it is Michigan State. I know Mark D'Antonio is completely fine with where they're ranked now, where their team is at. They lose a lot of guys too, but, you know, it seems like every time they do lose a lot of talent, they just restock and they're right there, you know, at the top of the Big Ten standings at the end of the year. So that's never a team I'm going to write off as long as Mark D'Antonio is their head coach. I know a lot of people, at least up here, you know, want to kind of, now that Jim Harbaugh seems to have the ball rolling in Ann Arbor, that Michigan State's going to fall by the wayside. I don't think so. I think as long as Mark D'Antonio's in East Lansing, that's a team that's going to have a fighting chance. And, which is why, you know, I have that game, that Michigan State and Michigan will play in late October. Really, that's the big test, because, like, you know, we could look at what a team has on paper today and say, oh, that, you know, that looks like a win for Michigan. But until you strap on the pads and, you know, until the clock hits zero on that day, you're not going to know. So that's definitely a team I would not count out.
Yeah, and you know what, Anthony, I might go a little further than what you just said. You kind of stopped short of saying they thrive on disrespect. I think they do. I think Michigan State always will. I think the little brother to Michigan thing will always bother them, even though they have owned Michigan, you know, at various points in time. I think they still feel like Urban Meyer gets a lot more credit than Mark D'Antonio does. Urban Meyer and his Heisman Trophy, you know, list of candidates every year. You know, they got JT Barrett and all this embarrassment of riches, and Michigan State just keeps kind of plugging along under the same, under the radar. I don't want to say under the radar, but not quite with the same national spotlight that Ohio State and Michigan operate under. And I think they do use that to their advantage. I think they really do feel like, you know, disrespect is something that's a weapon for them.
Yeah, it definitely is. Like I said, that's a team that's thrived on that. And, you know, no matter what people say about Jim Harbaugh or Urban Meyer, Mark D'Antonio is a guy that's gone out and beaten both of them. And as far as Ohio State goes, he's done it on their field a couple times. So that's a team that can never be counted out, as far as I'm concerned. They don't quite recruit to the level that Michigan and Ohio State do, but what they lack in stars, you know, whoever puts value into that, they make up for with coaching and the attitude and the kind of program that they've built. So, like I said, that's not a team I'm ever going to count out. You know, I won't believe that Michigan's a better team than them until I see it. On paper, does Michigan look better? Yes. Should Michigan win that game? Probably. But we'll see what happens in October.
We're talking to Anthony Broom once again of MaizeAndBrew.com, an SB Nation site devoted to covering the Wolverines. All right, let's talk about personnel again. We talked about John O'Korn maybe being the favorite in the battle with Wilton Spate, and I certainly can understand why, although they are a lot more similar than they are different. You know, both of them big, tall guys. I think, what, O'Korn is 6'4 and 225, and Spate is like 6'6 and 230 or whatever it is. They're both, you know, pocket passers who are going to have a lot of great, great targets to throw to. Also on MaizeAndBrew today, the highlight of the NFL.com writers, so this is a former scout for the Panthers and the Seahawks who's writing for NFL.com now, Bucky Brooks, his rankings of the top pass catchers in college football to look at, of course, as future you know, NFL prospects. And two of the top four are wearing maize and blue. Jake Butt, the tight end, All-American, and Jehu Chesson. So this is a great, great, you know, look, at least from a non-biased perspective. This is an NFL scout or an NFL guy saying that Michigan has got some top-flight weapons on offense.
Yeah, you know, depending on where you go, I've seen mock drafts for next year where, you know, those two guys are the top players of their position. They're talking Jehu Chesson is the number one receiver and Jake Butt is the number one tight end. I think that says a lot. And to be honest with you, I know, obviously they both decided to come back to school, both seniors, but I don't think we've seen their best football yet, or at least their most consistent football. You know, Jake Butt, he's as consistent as it gets. He doesn't drop many passes. He doesn't, you know, he's just very reliable. But at times I don't want to say Jim Harbaugh spreads the ball around so much that it's hard to feature a guy in his offense. That's a guy that I think could get the ball more. And Jehu Chesson, you know, early on in the season last year was a guy that was getting open, deep down the field. They weren't able to quite connect on those passes. And once they started doing that, that's when he really started to take off. So, and I don't think Jake Rudock had the arm that either of these quarterbacks do. So it's going to be interesting to see. I think those two guys have big years in store. Granted, they stay healthy. J.U. Chesson is still kind of coming back from an injury. I think it was a lower leg injury that he was working through, but he's still kind of coming back from that. But I think those two guys, their best football is ahead of them, and we'll see what that does for Michigan's offense.
One more thought on the offense before we talk about Jabril Peppers and his potential Heisman candidacy. I know it's a long shot, but still. And the defensive starters they return. But what about the running game? Who is going to key the running game?
I think it'll be Devion Smith. Tyron Wheatley has kind of fixated on him as the senior leader, the guy that that they expect the most out of. I'm not sure if it's going to be, he can quite be classified as a lead back, but I think he'll definitely get the most carries or the most percentage of carries out of them. Ty Isaac is a guy who, you know, if he can figure out, he had some fumble problems last year. If he can put it together, I know that's a guy that can do big things for them. They've gotten some freshmen in the running game. They both were early enrollees, Kingston Davis, Kareem Walker. You know, Wheatley has said throughout the offseason that if he feels like he can trust those guys, where if they can hold on to the football and, you know, do the little things right, that those are guys that are going to play too. So a lot of people talk about the tight ends and the fullbacks, guys that touch the ball a lot in Jim Harbaugh's offense, but I think they're going to rotate a lot of running backs too. So you'll definitely see a guy like Smith get the lion's share of the carries, but I think a lot of guys are going to touch the ball and get their fair share as well.
Let's move to the other side of the ball. Anthony Broom joining us. Jim Cushlin, jump in, of course, anytime you like as we talk Michigan football. We did a great Ohio State preview on Friday. We're talking Michigan football today. We will do some discussion on Michigan State, Notre Dame, and, of course, the two MAC teams that we cover so closely here, including the University of Toledo and Bowling Green as well. But let's talk about the defense. It is keyed by All-American Jabril Peppers. He is on everybody's All-American list. And some people saying, despite the hype around guys like Deshaun Watson at Clemson and Christian McCaffrey at Stanford and even JT Barrett at Ohio State, that if anybody who is not one of those key guys has a look at the Heisman, it is going to be a guy like Peppers.
Yeah, that's a guy that I know they're going to have him playing some linebacker. He'll play some safety. I'm sure he'll play some corner. Well, let's be honest. He'll probably play a little bit of everything. That doesn't involve a three-point stance. I know the other day at Media Day, coaches were kind of saying how that's a guy who even shows up early to kick field goals and stuff like that. So he's very much their do-it-all Swiss Army knife type of guy. And if there is a Heisman candidate on the roster, it's definitely him. He's huge for them. I think how they use him is going to be really key in, you know, just how good this defense is. You know, they had problems stopping the spread last year, and just kind of been a problem with them the last couple of years. But I think kind of sliding him down to linebacker, he's a more athletic guy. Have him roam sideline to sideline, do his thing. Just unleash him and let him play football. I think that's going to, you know, pay huge dividends for them. And, you know, I don't know what else to say about him. I mean, I don't think there's anything he can't do, and the sky's the limit for him. And that's
another
guy.
Is he the best defensive player in the country in your mind?
I think he's right up there. I can't think of many guys that are better than him or more versatile than him. And that's another guy I talked about, Butt and Chesson, and I think his best football is still ahead of him too. So we'll see what happens with him, but I'm very high on him. I know Michigan's very high on him. They're going to lean on him a lot. Definitely looking at playing him three ways, maybe some offense, definitely in return game and whatnot.
Who else is Jim Harbaugh going to key on, maybe not even just saying Jim Harbaugh, but obviously, you know, there's new names here and new faces here. They're going to play big roles in what the Wolverines are able to do, including a new defensive coordinator. So let's talk about who they're going to rely on. Jordan Lewis is a guy that gets a lot of hype and a lot of buzz, as well as Chris Wormley at the defensive end position. What are you expecting out of those guys, and who else can we, you know, kind of key on as this Big Ten season gets started, other than Jabril Peppers?
Yeah, I think Jordan Lewis is I think him and Desmond King in Iowa are kind of 1A and 1B in terms of, you know, the best cornerbacks in college football. Jordan Lewis is a little bit undersized, but what we saw out of him last year was, you know, he shuts down an entire side of the field, and that's absolutely huge for them. Michigan hasn't really had a player like that in a while. As far as Wormley goes, that's a guy who, you know, kind of, he'd always shown flashes, but he kind of came into his own last year. And I know that they had a lot of guys that they rotated up front, but he was probably the best of them. So expect him to lead the way up front. And then, a lot of people are saying a lot of good things about Rashawn Gary, the true freshman. He was the nation's number one recruit. He's been physically ready to play college football probably since he was a sophomore in high school. So I know they're gonna mix it up with him a little bit, play some tackle, he'll play some end. I know Michigan lost Willie Henry to the NFL, but you know, to lose a guy like that and then plug in, you know, a five-star guy and one of the best defensive linemen that have come out of high school in the last few years. That's, you know, I won't call it an upgrade yet, but I think they'll be fine there. Still some questions at linebacker, but I think they'll be able to figure it out. And I think this defense will pick up right where it left off.
So, Anthony Brew, before we let you run, and we appreciate your time from maizeandbrew.com, an SB Nation site devoted to covering the Wolverines. You may have answered this a little bit in Jim's question before about rankings and about the teams to beat in the Big Ten, but who is the bigger challenge? The defending champion? Is it Michigan State, or is it the Ohio State team that won the national championship 2 years earlier? A lot of different characters on both of those clubs, but they both remain the same consistent, extraordinarily well-coached programs that have quite frankly pounded on the Wolverines in recent years. So who's the bigger challenge for Harbaugh to get past and get over the top of if they want to win the Big Ten and possibly make the playoffs?
Well, I won't say they have the Michigan State game won, but you know, if not for a botched snap,
they did.
That's a
yeah, they did. I'll say it. I mean, come on. Not only, Anthony, did they have the game won, you know, all the punter has to do is catch it. Even if he doesn't get the punt off, for crying out loud, catch it and fall on it, you're still okay. But it had to be dropped, and then it had to bounce up just perfectly to a Michigan State guy in stride going the other way before anybody would have a chance to get a hand on him. Even if he's pushed out of bounds, the game ends. I mean, that is one of the most bizarre endings to a game that I can recall in recent years. So I'll say it. They had that game won, and it was a season changer, I think, for both of those teams. But be that as it may, it's a new year now, so go ahead.
Well, you're right. That was an apocalyptic disaster of epic proportions. So, yeah, that's what that was.
Indeed.
But that's a game they had won. I think the one that they really need to come out and prove themselves, and, you know, if nothing else, at least not get run off the field, is against Ohio State. You know, it's Michigan was pretty impressive all last year until Ohio State, the second half of that Ohio State game, they just kind of imposed their will. And I know Michigan had some injuries up front on the defensive line, but, you know, they can't get blown out by that team again. Not this group. And I don't think it will happen, but that's, you know, you have to take care of business in your own backyard with Michigan State. But you can't say that you're back until you beat Ohio State and then go out next year and do it again, because that's, you know, that's been, they pushed you around for the last decade or so and change. So that's the bigger challenge to me. That's the team that they need to get past, at least have a good showing on the road. I mean, they cannot get blown out again.
Yeah, and that's the thing. You know, in the standings, it was only a game difference, obviously, or a two-game difference with Michigan and Ohio State because of that loss. But on the field, it was a blowout, and it was embarrassing. And all of the stuff about how Michigan is back and they've closed the gap was really rendered moot, you know, when Urban Meyer put that thumping on Jim Harbaugh. I know that has driven Harbaugh, obviously, throughout the offseason. He has been loud. He has been proud. He has been in every city and every state with satellite camps. He's going down south and displaying the program to the folks in the SEC country and ticking everybody off, and that's great, and he is driven to close that gap. But until they get on the field and close that gap and they have either beat Ohio State or remind them that this is now a rivalry again, you know, then it's still going to be Ohio State. It's still going to be their conference. It's still going to be their rivalry, and that's the way it ought to be until Harbaugh proves something different. So great stuff there. Anthony Broom, maizeandbrew.com. Anthony, we look forward to talking to you throughout the season on Michigan news, maybe post-game reports and conversations during the week, all that sort of thing. So we hope you'll be able and willing to join us, because we certainly enjoy the time.
Of course, guys, anytime.
All right. Thank you so much, sir. Have yourself a great day. It's 4:33. There's Anthony Broom with the Michigan preview. Final 27 minutes of show are still to come. And we're going to open up the phone lines to whatever you want. You want to talk about this Big Ten preview? We'll do that. If you want to talk about some of what we discussed yesterday, the Tim Tebow story, you want to talk about what we did today in the first half hour of the show, the NFL's tier quarterback rankings have been released. And we're talking about not media members and not fans. We're talking about who NFL GMs, head coaches, coordinators, player personnel directors, club presidents, and more think the top quarterbacks in the National Football League are. It is a really controversial ranking, but I think it's very, very fascinating. And we started that with that at 4 o'clock. Maybe we'll pick that up on the other side of this timeout for SportsCenter right here on ESPN 106.5.
Be part of the extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
4:39 as we roll on. We got 20 more minutes of outstanding awesomeness for you on the extravaganza. Then another 60 of awesome from Mike Miller on Drive Time. So make sure you stay where you are. By the way, Jim Cushion, we would be remiss if we did not pay our respects, of course, to longtime ESPN host John Saunders. Far too young, 61 years old, for God's sake, 61 years old. John Saunders passed away earlier today. He has been one of the most familiar faces. He has been one of the most steady voices, one of the most respected journalists at ESPN for nearly three decades, for crying out loud. Seriously, he started when he was about just over 30 years old, and he did studio shows, play-by-play, he did SportsCenter, he was the host of the Sports Reporters, of course, one of my favorite shows, which used to be hosted by Dick Schaap before you know, he passed away, too. So just did everything. Knew everything, too. College football, basketball, the NHL, no matter what it was, he had a great voice on it. And when I say voice, I don't mean in vocal quality, like some people are just easy to listen to. Although he was that, too. Just a great, you know, great set of pipes and great delivery. But I mean great voice in terms of an authoritative voice. An authoritative voice, and yet a voice of reason and a voice of concern for others. And just a really sad thing to see somebody like John Saunders gone this early.
Yeah, no question about it. And obviously, you've been hearing on the various shows all day since we are ESPN Radio, of course. They've been talking about that and bringing up pretty much every guest. I remember hearing during Russillo and Cannell, Dick Vitale broke down on the air during that one, too, to boot. Yeah. So, he'll definitely be missed for all the reasons you said.
Yeah, and I those guys obviously are going to talk about him for days and days to come, all the way through his services, because they worked with him, and I've never met him. I've met a lot of these professional broadcasters before, a lot of the ESPN personalities, but I never met John Saunders. And I know him is the same way you know him, and that is as a very, very friendly, moral, reasonable voice, and an entertaining voice, and a deeply insightful voice on my television screen for so many years. So,
well said.
Yeah, deepest respects and condolences to John Saunders' family, his coworkers, his friends, and everybody else who knew him. It is just a very, very crushing thing for everybody at ESPN. And everybody, like I said, who's a sports fan, to be quite frank. All right, speaking of ESPN, we talked in the first hour of the program today. You know what? We got to do something about Michael Phelps, too. Michael Phelps, I wanted to get right back to the tier ranking system that ESPN polled. Mike Sando at ESPN polled on behalf of the NFL. 42 industry insiders, NFL insiders, 10 general managers. I had the entire list when we started out. I don't know if I still have. Yeah, I do. Here we go. They pulled 10 general managers. Let's see, among these 42, 5 head coaches, 7 offensive coordinators, 5 defensive coordinators, 8 personnel evaluators, and 7 other position coaches and executives. So we're talking about a real cross-section of those who know the most about the position and about the game. As far as the top quarterbacks, I want to get back to that ranking, which I find very interesting and a great topic of discussion for talk radio. But I also want to make sure we pay respect to Mr. Michael Phelps, the American Olympic hero of all time. My favorite Olympian for many, many years was Carl Lewis, because I love the fact that he was not just a sprinter, but he was also tremendous in the long jump. He was the world's best long jumper for a long time. You know, kept trying to break Bob Beamon's decades-old record, was never able to do it. Mike Powell eventually eclipsed him in that regard. But Carl Lewis, you know, winning 4 gold medals at an Olympics the way Jesse Owens did back in 1936, one of the greatest American athletes of all time, and he was my favorite. And he might still be. I don't know. I've got some sentimentality for those days and for his performance, too, with the expectations being their highest. But, my God, Michael Phelps now has 21 gold medals in the Olympics. I saw a stat, and I tried to talk about it yesterday, but I didn't have it in front of me. I couldn't find it. But I saw a stat that showed Michael Phelps' ranking in the world in terms of gold medals won in the history of the Summer Olympics, and he outpaced, I can't even tell you, like, that's why I said I don't have the stats in front of me, but he outpaced a ton of countries by himself in terms of gold medals won. But I did see another stat today that kind of puts this into a little bit of perspective. Most Summer Olympic gold since 2004. Number 10, Italy, 28 gold medals won. Number 11, Hungary, 23 gold medals won. Number 12, Michael Phelps, 21 gold medals won, tying him with the Ukraine. Number 14 is Netherlands, 18. I mean, he's up there with countries.
Yep, that's nuts.
12th most gold medals won since 2004. One guy. And he's not done. Jim, do I have it right? He's got three more events?
Yes, yeah, because there's all the different strokes and races and meters and all that. There's tons of swimming events. So, yeah, I believe he's got about three, maybe four more to go here in the coming days.
I think three. I think he could top out if he managed to sweep it at 24.
That's
which is,
nuts.
Again, just impossible to comprehend. Greenberg and Golic this morning, and I always like to listen to Mike and Mike. I reference them a lot on this program because I tell you, you should be listening to them too. You should have already heard this stuff. Mike and Mike in the morning, when they're both there especially, it's awesome. but they were talking about it this morning, and I think it was Greenberg, who pointed out that the Olympics, of course, are only every 4 years.
Right.
The World Championships are every 2 years. Okay. Since 2001, when Michael Phelps raced for the first time as a 15-year-old, in international world championships.
Of course, he's from Michigan, by the way.
Yes, he is.
Don't forget that around here.
When Michael Phelps won his first gold medal back in 2001, between 2001 and now 15 years, he has also won 26 gold medals at the world championships. He's got 47 gold medals by himself at the two highest levels of highest levels of international swimming competition. 26 in the World Championships, which is, again, every 2 years, and it is the highest competition in the world outside of the Olympics. And they have it every 2 years. But then you add that to the Olympics, 47 gold medals by himself. You know what I want to know? What does he do with his silvers? I'm just asking, because his total medal count, I think, is he's got 21 Olympic golds, and I want to say 25 overall medals. So that means he's got four silvers or maybe a couple silvers and a couple bronze. I don't know, and I should probably look that up. But I'm just curious. When you've got 21 golds, what do you do with your silvers? I would imagine those
coasters,
are in a box.
No, they're coasters for your drinks. No big
deal.
Yeah,
well, okay, there you go. I was going to say, I don't know if you'd want anybody to see them. Because, you know, they're embarrassing. I was second for a couple of races. I was second. Those are in a box up in the attic collecting dust. They're up there. I mean, seriously, when you've got 21 golds on display in your home in various trophy cases or under
or
glass.
However or however he has it lined up.
Or whatever you do. Yeah, I mean, I would imagine the silvers. I mean, let's put it to you this way. If you walk into Michael Phelps' home, and I have no idea what kind of home he lives in, I'm just picturing something really, really nice and extravagant and extraordinary displays of his gold medals under glass, on his walls, you know, I don't know, maybe grouped by Olympics, you know, eight from the 2008 games, I think, or was it the 2012 games?
I lost count, honestly, of how many he was
won.
But
he won a
record
eight in one Olympics.
Right.
And I think that was 2008, maybe. And then another, I don't know, six in 2012, and he's going for another six or so in this Olympics in 2016. Maybe he's got him grouped under glass by Olympic Games. But however it is, you know, if you walk into his home and they're on his wall on display for everyone to see, and there's gold here under this glass, there's a whole bunch of golds under this one, a whole gold, and then over on the side wall over there, there's a bunch of silvers hanging. Are you even walking over to that hallway? I mean, why don't I see those? What is that? Why do you even have those out, man? Yeah, 21 golds. What are those? And the sad thing is, Jim, I'm making light of it, not intentionally. I'm just blown away by this guy's accomplishments. I'm not really trying to make light of this, but in truth, any one Olympic athlete, any one American athlete who goes to the Olympics, and most of them only get one Olympics. Let's be clear
maybe
about
two.
That.
Too. Yeah, maybe two, depending on event
depending
and age.
Depending on their age and how good they are when they started. You know, if they're in their teens and they go to an Olympics, and then 4 years later, you know, they're 22 or 23 or something like that, they might still be in their prime and do it. But as you know, you have to make it through the Olympic trials to get back every 4 years.
Especially in, especially in sports like swimming. There are all the little trials you have to go to. And I believe his debut for Phelps was the 2000 games in Athens, because if I'm not mistaken, isn't this his fifth Olympics?
I don't know that. I just know they were talking on Greeny and Golick this morning about the 2001 being his start. Maybe that was his first world championships. I think that was probably his first world championships, where they said he had 26 golds in the world championships. But now I lost my train of thought there on that, about his totals. Doggone it, Jimmy interrupted me and you blew me up. My ADHD kicked in and I can't remember where I was going with that. But at any rate, Michael Phelps' gold medals. I remember now about how many times you get a chance to go back.
Right. Okay.
Very, very few, especially the gymnasts. You know, the U.S. gymnastics team won.
Oh, yeah.
Team won the gold again yesterday as well. That's their second straight time they've won the team gold, as I understand it. These girls are getting pushed out most of the time by a new batch of great young gymnasts.
Yep.
You know, and for whatever reason, it's just really hard to maintain that world class level where I can compete in the U.S. Olympic trials and make it back again next year. Only the elite athletes, the Usain Bolts, who can come back Olympics after Olympics and be the fastest in the world, Michael Phelps, etc. Very few get to do this. My point to that is, a first-time Olympian, and maybe an only-time Olympian, who finishes second in the world at the most prestigious athletic competition, international athletic competition in the world, finishing second and getting a silver medal, is the highlight of their life. I mean, they'll never do anything better or more important outside, of course, of the obvious. You know, getting married, having their children, you know, that is, of course, almost, I think any normal parent would tell you that's the greatest day of their life, is the day they had their children, they bore their children, etc. But anyway, I mean, as far as personal accomplishments, it's the greatest thing they'll ever do. You win a silver medal for your Olympics, you're a hero. They're throwing a parade. If somebody in Toledo wins a silver medal at an Olympic Games, there's probably going to be some kind of proclamation, some sort of a key to the city, some sort of a parade. And I don't know how many gold medals there have come out of Toledo or any of the other surrounding communities, but especially in smaller communities, too. They're going to do something extraordinary for you because of that great accomplishment and how you represented their town, their community, their city, their state to the rest of the world. Michael Phelps has four of those things that probably just mean, you know, like you said, they're coasters. They're just add-ons. They're over there somewhere. I don't know. I left them down in the other room. They're hanging in the bathroom where people can look at them and just use them as motivation. because they don't mean anything to me because I got 21 gold medals. That's the point I was trying to get at with all of this, and I want to pay the proper respects to him. Now, I think, as I said, that he's got three more. Again, listening to Golick and Greenberg this morning, I think he's got three more events that he's competing in this Olympics, so he could finish with 24. And here's the crazy thing. He's 31 years old. No one, again, as I understand it, has ever won as many gold medals in a single Olympics at this age in swimming before. So forget about the grand total of 21 thus far. Just winning the three golds that he's won, or is it two so far this Olympics? Two.
It's two. And I know one of them was with a team.
Well, yeah, well, of course. So, I mean, a number of them are. That's the relay.
Because that's the other thing. You know, it's not just, you got the relay teams, too. So, you know, we're talking about the amount of events. You got the individual events. You got the team events as well.
Yeah,
on a sport like swimming.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously. It's the same thing with Carl Lewis, like I said. You know, you have your sprint, your 100, you have your 200, you have your long jump, and then you have the 4x1 relay.
Exactly.
So you still have to be a part of a world-class team in order to do this. But all of them mean the same. It's not as though one is less impressive than the others because it was a part of a team thing. It's the same thing that everybody else is doing. By the way, here it is. Michael Phelps has won more gold medals. No, I'm sorry. Won more Olympic medals than 91 countries.
And, for some of you out there, medals. There's at least 91 countries on this planet, by the way, too. So you learned something today.
Well, there's more than that.
I know. I said at least.
Oh, yeah. Okay. There you go. He has won more than 91 countries, including Portugal, Peru, Singapore, Serbia, and 87 others. They're just picking some names. Anyway, his 25 gold Olympic medals, 21 of them are gold. His gold medal count so far in the Rio Games is in line with his overall trend of domination. He's won three so far in this Olympics. Three, not two. He's won three so far, which is as many as Germany, Sweden, Netherlands, and Chinese Taipei have this Olympics. His medal count of three thus far in just Rio is more than that of 189 other countries that are competing there, 159 of which currently have zero, 30 of which have one or two. Athletes from the United States have won 27 overall. And I want to get back to Phelps here. And I can't find what I'm looking for, but that's okay, because my point that I was getting at was this. He won his first world championships, gold medals, at 15. Nobody had ever done that before. He's winning three golds at an Olympic Games at 31. Nobody has ever done that before. They were speculating today. Who's to say this is the end? Who's to say if he's already broken all of those barriers for age on the young end and on the older end, that he can't come back at 35 and win two more or three more? Whether it's individually or as part of the relay teams that you just mentioned, Jim, who's to say that Michael Phelps has a ceiling here? I don't understand. Yeah. I can't imagine what would slow him down. I mean, look at the national football. Look at Tom Brady. Didn't Tom Brady just turn 39?
I believe so, yeah.
He could have been the MVP last year. You could have made a strong case for him as the MVP of the National Football League. How old is LeBron James?
Was it 32?
31.
Or 31. He'll be 32 this
December. Same as Michael Phelps.
Yeah.
And guess what? LeBron James is still considered to be the best player in the NBA. Physically, no slower than he was than when he was, 25. Well, who's to say that Michael Phelps, who's also 31, can't be doing the same thing at 35? If LeBron James turns 35 4 years from now and is still doing the kinds of things he's doing, then why can't Michael Phelps? So he might, I don't know where this is going to end. I'm not going to say 30 gold medals, but all I know is that when you have an individual who has won more gold medals in his career than 91 international countries, for goodness sakes, you are talking about maybe the greatest athlete in the history of sport. And that's a tough thing to decide. I asked your fill-in yesterday, Mr. Lahowski, Jim, if Michael Phelps, because of all of these numbers we're talking about, does this make him possibly the greatest athlete ever? And Ben said, oh, no way. No way. There's never any way. He said LeBron James would be better than that. I was like, wait a second. Wait, based on what? This guy's won 21 gold medals in international Olympic competition and 47 overall. Yeah. Based on what? And Ben thought it was a popularity thing. He said, well, LeBron is way more popular. Well, a lot more people watch LeBron than Michael Phelps. I'm saying, and this is what I explained to Ben, and I'll say it again now, and I don't want to be redundant for those who were listening at the end of yesterday's show, but I guess I'll have to be. Michael Phelps is probably better at swimming than anybody else is at anything else. That's the criteria there. He swims better than anybody else runs. He swims better and with more dominance than anybody else throws or catches or kicks or pedals or I don't know, whatever else anybody can do. Nobody else has done it as well as Michael Phelps has done swimming. And I think that's just the best way to say it.
I have to agree with that sentiment. I mean, whether you want to say he's the greatest American athlete ever, that's a little separate conversation, I think. And I don't know what the criteria would be on that, but
well, that would be my criteria right there. Just better at what you do than everybody else is at what they do.
Well, certainly the point is, on any kind of conversation like that going forward, he has to be one of the first names in the conversation without question.
By the way, he won 8 gold medals in Athens in 2004 and 8 more in Beijing in 2008 and then 6 in London in 2012, and he has 3 in Rio through last night.
Crazy.
And he still has 3 more events to go. So it's just so much fun to watch. All right. Thanks so much for joining us and listening to us as we kind of bebop around all over the sports map today. It was really good stuff. Enjoyed the stuff with our guests, too. Thanks to Anthony Broom and thanks to Anthony Fennec. And tomorrow, I don't think we'll have any Anthony's for you, but we will have another extravaganza. We'll see you then.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off 2 or more select major appliances. Plus, get 3 Scott's Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help. you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.